sanctuary to hear a very informative and entertaining presentation. I think a number of you were here for that when the character actor Gerry Anderson offered a dramatic portrayal of the life and times of Clarence Darrow. And while his portrayal included the role incorporated into his presentation, the role that Darrow played in the 1925 Scopes trial in Nathan, Tennessee, where his legal opponent was William James Bryan, that one particular piece of Darrow's life did not dominate, it was not the predominant one in the presentation. And this was rightly done, I thought, because there was, as you know, much more to Clarence Darrow's life and legal career than his defending the thesis of evolution in that one particular trial. Well, the night before, though, that Gerry did his presentation here about Darrow, he offered, for anybody who wanted to just come and listen and help critique it a little bit, another presentation that he's working on for another act that he's hoping to get together. And the historical figure that he's working up for that portrayal is, in fact, William Jennings Bryan, who was Darrow's opponent in the Scopes trial. As both a well-seasoned lawyer and as a very great orator and a devout Christian fundamentalist, Bryan was, as you know, the leader for the prosecution in that same Scopes trial. And as was the case with his enactment of Darrow, Mr. Anderson did not devote an inordinate amount of attention to the image of William Jennings Bryan that comes out of the Scopes trial. He took into account instead the man's much larger political and legal career. And this too, I thought that was rightly done as I sat and watched it, because it confirmed for me something that I long suspected, but I've never really explored all that closely, which is that Bryan has been given something of a bad rap by many of us religious liberal types. Sort of William Jennings Bryan is on my long list of people I need to learn more about. I think there's a couple new biographies out on him, so maybe I'll get to them, I hope. Anyway, but thanks to his role in that Scopes trial, Bryan tends to get pigeonholed as something of a know-nothing anti-intellectual guy. But most human lives, certainly including the ones all of us are living, do not fit into neatly packaged or prepackaged categories, Mr. Bryan's included, even if this is the one that he's kind of gotten shoved into. Well, this is not going to be a sermon on the life and times of William Jennings Bryan, but I'm going to very briefly touch on it for the next couple of minutes. He was, putting it mildly, a very enigmatic figure. He was the Democratic Party's nominee for United States President on 3 campaigns, always running and always losing on a populist and progressive platforms. As the great commoner, he was a champion of the rights of working men and women. He was an early advocate of labor reform. He was a strong advocate of a woman's right to vote. He was instrumental in having United States senators elected by popular vote rather than either appointed by state governors or whatever processes state legislatures had, thereby making the United States Senate a much more democratic body than it had been. He was, that is to say, on the same side of a number of social issues as were our Unitarian and Universalist forebears. And the thing I find most striking about Bryan's political career is that he resigned his office as Secretary of State under President Woodrow Wilson, because he could not, in good conscience, support that president's decision to take the United States into World War I. Imagine that. Secretary of State resigning to protest the president's decision to go to war. Whatever your opinion of his stance on that particular issue, whether it was taking into account certain global realities or not, I think you have to give him points for personal integrity. He was not going to pretend to support a policy or an action which, in good faith and conscience, he could not personally stand behind. And Mr. Bryan, as I said, was also a Christian fundamentalist. Not entirely, because during the Scopes trial, he wavered a little bit on whether the day referred to in the first chapter of Genesis was strictly one of 24 hours or not. He gave a little bit of wriggle room on that, but he became a forceful opponent of evolution and of it being taught in the public schools for three basic reasons. First was, he viewed it as an atheistic assault on his religion and on the religious principles of the parents who sent their children to public school, and in that respect, he cast himself in the role of defender of the faith. Well, since then, I think we've achieved a pretty broad-based national consensus that the public schools do not exist to promote a particular religious point of view. But that was really not the case in 1925, and Bryan at that time was arguing for a pretty broadly held cultural consensus. But he had two other reasons for fearing and opposing this theory, and that's the ones that I want to focus on a little more, because it gives us at least maybe some insight into why this continues to be such a passionate issue, even in this day, we're some, 80 years past the Scopes trial. Well, I figured, though, if there was ever a case of somebody preaching to the choir, it would be for me to defend the theory of evolution in front of a Unitarian Universalist congregation. So I'm not going to do that. I don't feel the need to. I really think, just reflecting what I said, that a little better use of our time right now would be to look at where some of the opposition to it is coming from, which I believe runs far deeper than trying to cling to a literal interpretation of a set of Bible verses, even though that is what Bryan, in some respect, was attempting to do. But he was doing more than that. In his mind, he was also defending many of the social values and principles and causes that he fought for during the course of his political career. His question was this: if the true story of life on this planet, including human life, was that of the stronger and more versatile elements of a species surviving and evolving at the expense of the weaker and more dependent elements, he wanted to know what that meant for social policy. If the right and true nature of things on this planet was a triumph of the strong and the powerful over the weak, then why do we bother with such things as morality and ethics, especially when it comes to protecting the poor and the weak, because after all, they're just kind of gumming up the natural order of things. This is a stance not entirely unlike that taken by Senator Ayn Rand's disciples today, as a matter of fact. Bryan and his followers and his adherents really believed that if there was no God who had specifically and deliberately created human beings as a separate species like no other, and if this same God had not given this special human species a set of morals and ethics to live by, then it really was a jungle out there in which only the fittest would indeed survive. This was his fear. And for Mr. Bryan, his opposition to the theory of evolution then was entirely consistent with his political career of standing up for the poor, the weak, the downtrodden, against the wealthy and the powerful. He was afraid the theory of evolution would be simply used as a rationale for the weak and powerful people to continue in oppressive kinds of ways. The other related fear Bryan had in his day, as do his spiritual descendants of his day, was and is that of meaninglessness. One of his anti-evolution arguments was that if the story of life on Earth is no more than that of simpler life forms evolving into more complex life forms with human beings eventually coming out of that process, then, so he reasoned, our intrinsic worth is really no more than that of a mosquito that we reflexively swat out of existence whenever it annoys us. If we are not God's crowning act of creation, as the book of Genesis teaches, so Bryan reasoned, then our lives have no inherent meaning. Absent a creator God, not only are we without any kind of morality, we are also adrift on a sea of meaninglessness. To briefly go back a few centuries, this was actually the very same kind of fear that Galileo found himself up against when he put forth his discoveries that the Earth was really not at the center of the universe after all. The charge against him was that he was violating the teachings of the Church. The fear behind the charge was that he had rendered the Earth insignificant. But you see, the official interpretation, the official church interpretation of that first verse of the first verse of Genesis, the beginning chapter of the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That was taken to mean that the earth was the last piece of the universe that God had created and was deliberately placed at the center of the universe so that all the heavens revolved around it. And this idea, there was a certain symmetry there, this idea very neatly corresponded to the idea that the human creature was the last act of creation and was placed at the center of the created order of humans. So the church authorities of Galileo's day reasoned that the earth is just one more planet revolving around one more star among all the millions of stars in the universe. There's no meaningful life to be had here. And so strong was the church's authority, Galileo, for the sake of his earthly well-being, eventually recanted his findings, even though in the back of the mind he knew that they were still correct. And it really wasn't until 1984, just over 20 years ago, that the church officially acknowledged that Galileo had been right all along. I think they'd come to that understanding sometime before that, but it took 300 years to officially accommodate his findings to their own theology and teachings. Now, given that time change, maybe in another 300 years we will see married men, women, priests. Who knows? Anyway, this is what I see as being the issue, behind the issue, or these kinds of elements are what I see as being the issues behind the issue and over this never-ending debate of evolution and creationism, with the idea of intelligent design being its latest variation. The issue behind the issue is how we find meaning in our lives, how we meaningfully live with one another, and what kind of stories do we tell to help us in that search and to help us answer those questions. So, having endless debates, I think, over who has better science doesn't really get at it. That's like a couple arguing over who's doing the better job of keeping the house best cleaned up, when what they're really arguing over usually runs far deeper than that. Any family therapist will tell you that their first task in working with any sort of a troubled relationship or a troubled family is locating the real issue behind what is usually the presenting issue. You know, family comes in and says, we're having this kind of a problem. First of all, the therapist has got to figure out is what's the real problem here above and beyond or below what this presenting issue is. So let's think then for a few moments of this creation evolution issue as the presenting issue, with the deeper one being that of story. And that's what I'm thinking, that the real issue is one of story. Now, how come? I think it's because we human beings do not live by scientific principles and theories alone. We can't live without them, for sure, in this day and age, if we're going to survive and thrive and grow on this planet, but we ultimately live by our stories. For it is the stories that we as a human race tell that guide us in our search to a better understanding of who we are and why we're here and what we mean to one another. And you can see this on any number of levels. Each one of you here carries a family name with you. And having that family name gives you a story that informs you and tells you about who you are and why you're here and maybe why you do some of the things that you do. So the reason being a Smith or a Jones or a Eddington means something to the persons who bear those names and so many other names is, as I say, because of the family stories behind them, far more so than who procreated with whom and when. Same thing goes with us, a country or a nation. Part of our identity comes from the country or the nation that we are a citizen of. And it is more than just a recounting the story of who we are as Americans or whatever country we may happen to be a citizen of. It's more than just a recounting of a succession of historical occurrences. It's telling a story and seeing how we fit into that story. We can take that from family identity, to national identity, to human identity itself. What's the story that gives us our larger and our ultimate identity as human beings on this planet, tells us what it really means to be human? This is the story, or stories, that religions have traditionally provided. Or for some, it's a particular philosophy, or the pursuit of some form of spirituality that gives them their ultimate, what I would say, their ultimate human story. I'd say for myself, it's kind of a mix of all three: religion, philosophy, spirituality. I doubt I'm alone in that regard. And so as I see it, the issue behind the issue for the creationists is the fear of a loss of story and what that loss might portend. And since we now unavoidably live in a scientific era, then the creationists are going to fight for their story on the scientific front, which gives us such constructs as scientific creationism or intelligent design. As I said earlier, I'm not going to jump into that debate today. What I'm going to try to do instead, next few minutes, is relate the story that I tell myself that in turn gives me my primary identity, tells me who I am as a human being, in addition to all the other identities I have of family, nation, and race, gender, and all those other ways we identify ourselves. This is a story that accepts the premise of a multi-billion-year-old universe. That number seems to change from time to time. But it accepts the premise of a multi-billion-year-old universe that was initiated by an event colloquially called the Big Bang, and of at least one planet in that now vast universe whose life forms have evolved to the point where at least one of its species, who's decided to call itself Homo sapiens, needs to tell stories about who they are. There could be other planets somewhere where that same kind of thing has happened, but this is the only one that we know of at the moment. So with all of that as a backdrop, what I would say is the human story, or the story I'm looking to tell, the very first line of this story would be a variation on the line that we were having some fun with a few weeks ago as we got ready for our service auction here on that Casablanca theme. Of all the planets and all the galaxies and all the universe, we had to show up here. Here. On a celestial body that is brought forth in the course of millions of years, and in ways we're still trying to figure out, a certain kind of living creature who can step outside of itself and look at itself and ask itself questions about who it is. This same creature has even come up with a way of getting itself, momentarily at least, completely off of its home planet, so it can take a look at the whole place where it's living. Take a picture of itself. See itself out there in the vastness of all the universe that's around it. It can see itself in the vastness of creation. And I say creation because, yes, I do believe there is a creative process going on. Whether there's a willful creator behind it or not, I'm an agnostic on that one. And to pick up this story once again, once this creature got to the point where it could stand outside of itself and look at itself and ask questions of itself, in the course of doing that, it came to create great works of art, music, literature. It used its powers of thought and imagination to build tribes, and then societies, and civilizations. It used these same powers of thought and imagination to at least begin ways of understanding the workings of a larger world and universe in which it was located. And this creature told its stories about how and why it came to be here. And those stories changed and developed as wider ranges of knowledge informed the thought and the imagination of this creature. And some of these stories became the basis for its many and varied religions. And fairly early on, in its collective life, this creature also discovered that it was capable of doing some pretty horrible and destructive things to itself and to the other creatures that it shared the planet with, and even to the planet itself. It discovered as well that it could do some great and wonderful and life-enhancing things for itself and its planet and the other creatures it shared it with. And it wondered about this. And it created certain kinds of agreements and understandings among its members that would both serve as a protection from its more dark, destructive, life-denying side, and that would also strengthen its life-enhancing side. And these agreements came to be called codes of ethics and morality and law. And these codes changed as the creature's understanding of itself and the world changed, but the basic reason for the agreements remained the same. And sometimes those agreements were kept. And sometimes they were broken. And sometimes the cost this creature paid for breaking them was very dear when it came to things like wars and indifference to the suffering of people. And that cost continues to be very dear to this very day. And one more thing, one more piece to this creaturely story. As this creature that came to call itself human learned more about its own story, it came to see, we came to see, a relationship. It was a relationship which held that all the various kinds of life on this planet were connected to one another, that each one depended upon the other for its life and livelihood. And it and we are still trying to learn the full meaning of this relationship. We're still trying to learn how we best treat one another as related members of what we have come to call the human family. And how best we treat, how best we most meaningfully live and participate in this whole chain of life that this planet contains. That is the spiritual question. That's the spiritual challenge that this creature, who we are, has now come to encounter. How do we connect? How do we experience? How do we most meaningfully and responsibly live within this circle of life, this chain of life that has brought us forth? Well, that's the story that gives the human life that I'm trying to live its meaning. It's not a story that neatly provides answers in some cleanly packaged way, but it's a story that hopefully will point me and can point us in the direction of those answers, knowing that my knowledge is incomplete and will still be incomplete when the life I've been given is no longer mine. So this, as I see it, is our story. Much of that story remains in the realm of mystery and wonder, and we continue to probe in that realm. Whether or not there is some great, willful purpose behind this story is part of the mystery of it. For me, I'll just live within the story itself and see whatever mysteries are revealed. I will say I don't believe that I am the child of a supreme being, but I do believe that I am a child of the earth and all that has brought me forth. And that implies a relationship of responsibility. So I'll wrap up on this. The story I've told, and most of you could probably tell your own variation of it, it's one, and here's the difference between it and the more traditional story. It's one that places us within a larger and ever-growing chain or circle of life, rather than seeing us as the final crowning, crowning and end result of life itself, the end result of a timeline. It is within this chain that we affirm our worth and dignity and extend that worth and dignity to our fellow human beings. It is within this chain that we search for ways to show compassion for all creatures with whom we share a relationship. It is within this chain that we keep searching for ever deeper ways of knowing what our interdependence means and what it calls us to be, what it calls us to do. And finally, while this story cannot be told completely within the while this story can be told, I believe, completely within the confines of the natural world and universe, within that world, I find, within that realm, I find a certain miraculous quality about it. Within this natural world, I believe I still can find what I consider to be sacred, holy, if not divine. Because what we have here is the miracle of existence itself. The miracle of our ability to know and experience. It is the miracle of which the Buddhist monk and teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, wrote about in a passage that I'd like to close with this morning. It's called mindfulness. I like to walk on country paths, rice plants and wild grasses on both sides, putting each foot down on the earth in mindfulness, knowing that I walk on a wondrous earth. In such moments, existence is miraculous, and it is a mysterious reality. People usually consider walking on water or in thin air a miracle, but I think the real miracle is not to walk either on water or in thin air, but to walk on the earth. Every day, we are engaged in a miracle we don't even recognize. A blue sky, white clouds, green leaves, the black, curious eyes of a child, our own two eyes. All is miracle. On that note, let's sing together a closing hymn. Earth was given. Garden, it's number 207.